Welcome to the Infotagen podcast, focused on the work of the Joint Select Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. I'm Damien Collins, the host of this podcast and also the chair of the committee. At our most recent evidence session, we heard from Ian Russell, the chair of trustees of the Molly Rose Foundation, Izzy Wick from the Five Rights Foundation, Nina Jankovic from the Aletha Group in Washington, D.C., Claire Pelham from the Epilepsy Society, and Matt Harrison from MenCap. In this evidence session, we were focused on further evidence of the harm caused to individuals as a consequence of hate speech, the physical harm that can be caused by people with epilepsy having content directed at them, as well as the question of what the platforms are doing themselves to moderate and control content that can cause real harm. We'll hear first from Beban Kidron, Baroness Kidron, who's questioning Ian Russell about the role that amplification of harmful content can cause from the perspective of the person who is on the receiving end of that content.
Do you think that we're missing the point when we think about content as being the content that one bad actor sends to another or one bad actor sends to a child, that actually there's this swathe of availability?
There is swathe of availability. 197,000 is a big number. And there are different sort of orders of magnitude. Direct online bullying is particularly bad. And I met on a trip to the US, I met another parent bereaved by suicide, and their child had been online bullied directly, direct messaged by people at their high school in New Jersey. And their story was tragic and horrible. And because the bullying from a small number of people was so direct and so targeted, it probably had a greater effect on that child. But the huge amount, hundreds of thousands of posts of content that can be harmful in the very many other ways that harm can be brought to bear, particularly in young and vulnerable people, means that just by going online, you're dipping your toe into a dangerous water. Now, the beach might look shallow and it might look quite calm, but it's all too quick before you're sucked out of your depth, if you like. Just a few misplaced search terms can send you in the wrong place. And in a way, it's being a person online that's dangerous. I think we all have to admit that, and it doesn't matter what age you are. We just have to remember that every time you go online, there's potential danger. We have to moderate our behavior online, and we have to think about how we are affected when we go online. And it's hard enough for an adult to do that. It's very, very hard for a young child or a vulnerable person to do that.
We'll now hear from Nina Jankovic discussing with the committee the importance of being very specific about the types of harmful content that we want companies to act against, and also being specific about how they should do that on different platforms.
I'll just draw an analogy to Germany's NetzDG law, which is similar in some ways to what's being proposed. And the specificity issue in Germany has been extremely important and kind of hindered some of the progress that Germany has made in terms of regulating social media and content moderation, in that, and in their transparency reporting that they've required of the social media companies, they've kind of created blanket categories that don't necessarily apply to every platform. Obviously, the types of engagements and types of content on each platform vary greatly. So I think the more specificity that is asked for in terms of both reporting and also risk assessment, the better. And those should be tailored to each platform as well, because comparing YouTube and Facebook or YouTube and TikTok against Parler or whatever is like comparing apples and oranges or comparing a cow to a tree. They're really quite different. So I think as specific as you can get, that will render much more practicable data and give you a better understanding of what is actually going on. If you're at 40,000 feet, you're really not going to see what's going on in the weeds.
We've got the models to do that, have we? I mean, we're not just sort of praying for some great risk assessment, that it hasn't yet been invented.
I mean, the social media platforms can do that if they're compelled to do it. I think the point that Izzy made before about marking your own homework rings true here. You'd need to determine, or Ofcom would need to determine, exactly what measures they'd like to see and compel the social media platforms to hand over that data. They have it. It's just a question of getting it from them.
We can hear now John Nicholson, who is raising with Claire Pelham the question of harmful content directed at people with epilepsy and what motivates people to send content like that, which could cause real physical harm to epilepsy sufferers.
I'd like to know more about the motivations of people who do this. Who are these awful people? You refer to them as gangs. Who would want to send flashing images to somebody living with epilepsy, which would cause them to crash their car?
It's almost impossible to understand. I mean, we have really tried, because we thought that if we could understand, we might be able to work with these people and help them to understand their behaviour is causing such pain to the victims of it. But all we can think of is that they are people who have not yet had the education and exposure that many of us have had to what an equal society that includes disabled and non-disabled people.
It's a bit more than that, isn't it? You might not care very much about disabled rights, but you wouldn't want actively to kill somebody. Are these people psychopaths? Who are they? Who are these monsters?
I have to. We, all of us at the Epilepsy Society, have to believe that if we work well and effectively enough, we will be able to defeat stigma against people with epilepsy. But throughout history, there has been a very sad tradition of being unkind and hateful to people with epilepsy. And to pick up the point that you made earlier, that this was very much on the decline until the popularity of online media, and it has bounced up. It really has. I'm afraid we haven't done a survey about it, but we can see it. Anecdotally, we can see it, that there are many, many people with epilepsy who won't tell you that they have epilepsy because of these folk out there. And it's heartbreaking.
But Could it be that they just don't think that people online are real people?
I think there's an element of that. I think it's a very different thing, perhaps, to sit in your bedroom doing hate-filled things, perhaps after a drink, I don't know, than it is to look somebody in the eye.
Nina Jankovic now tells the committee about some of the tools that are available today that help users make their own experience safer online by using different tools that can personalise that experience and put them in more control of what they see.
There is an example, slightly afield of normal social media, where this has come up, and that's the dating app Bumble, which is the app where women can message men first. Their lobbying team has taken it upon themselves to pursue some really strict legislation about unsolicited nude photographs from users, and really is putting user safety first. And I've not done a study on this, but anecdotally, I know a lot of women prefer that app because of how safe they feel there. And they're introducing constantly more features for safety. Another interesting comparison is this plugin called Block Party, which is available on Twitter. And Block Party allows users to kind of segment off certain abusive content so that you don't have to look at it and deal with it. In fact, you can even assign someone to deal with it and report things and go through it for you. It's a very useful app for those who have a lot of mentions, who receive a lot of vitriol. I know a lot of reporters who use it. And Twitter has actually started to incorporate some of the means by which you can filter and block that content into their own platform. So that's an instance in which an open platform like Twitter, allowing a plugin like that to be developed, has led to policy change at the platform level. Of course, Facebook doesn't allow that. So I think the opening up of the API of these platforms in order for user safety applications to be developed would be a positive development.
Next, Guy Black raises with Nina Jankovic the question about how difficult it is to get proper data and reporting from the platforms to analyze the way that harmful content is spreading on them.
Well, I'll start with that. Piggybacking off of the report that we did, you might have realized if you took a look at it that Facebook is not one of the six platforms that we analyzed, and that is because of the lack of access to data. We looked at three alternative platforms and three more mainstream platforms, and the ones that we chose were ones that had open access, because otherwise you're comparing apples and oranges again. Facebook does have its CrowdTangle social listening software, which may be under threat of being shut down. It's how most researchers understand what's going on the platform, but in that, we only have access to 2% of the total content on Facebook, because it's only public content that is indexed there. So we don't know the degree of abuse that was being perpetrated in the 2 months ahead of the US 2020 election in private or in private groups. And it's staggering when you are a member of these groups, as many journalists and researchers will create their own sock puppet accounts to kind of listen and look there to see what isn't being reported on. And it's Facebook will say, oh, you know, it's just this group, or it's just, you know, a couple of posts. But we really have no idea. And it's very difficult to gauge. And that's why not only do I think access to researchers for that data is extremely important, as long as it's pseudonymized, but those transparency reports will provide a lot of detail and richness that we frankly don't have, and allow us to hold social media platforms to account rather than them banner waving every time they do a takedown that they're proud of.
Finally, Izzy Wick raises an important question relating to the drafting of the bill, and that is the question as to whether there should be a general duty of care of online platforms towards their users, rather than just the specific duties and obligations that are set out in the draft bill.
We recognise that the bar has been set very high for these companies. We've engaged very productively with officials over the drafting period, and there are many elements of the bill which reflect those good conversations that we've had. But what I would say is there are two major elements of the bill that have changed since the full government response to the white paper back in December, which are of great concern to us. The first is around the general duty of care. What we have now is a laundry list of duties, and we seem to have lost this overarching duty of care to address reasonably foreseeable harms. And I think the issue with this is that it won't necessarily future-proof the bill, and it won't account for kind of emerging technologies and associated risks, which will mean the regulator is constantly behind the curve. So we think a much more straightforward approach would be to reintroduce this general duty of care to fulfil the safety objectives of the bill, which are excellent. And then the second is around the scope of the harms that the bill will address. The current draft has been a rebadging. So what we have is a content bill. It focuses only on harmful user-generated content, when actually we need to be thinking about the whole range of risks that children and others face online. And I think to do that, we need to bring back in the word activity. So it needs to be looking at content and activity, which should bring in all those things that we've addressed today about the systems and processes of these platforms and the other types of risks that children face online, as well as content risks.
I'm joined now by my colleague on the committee, John Nicholson. And John, I wanted to start off by looking back at the questions you asked about epilepsy in front of the committee, because I think this is quite an interesting topic, a very important one, but I think something that sometimes gets missed from the debate around harmful content online, which is not just bad things people say about each other, but actually targeting someone with a known medical condition with content that could give them a seizure, could actually greatly harm them physically.
I mean, who knew that this was a thing? I didn't know this. The Epilepsy Society got in touch with me and told me, and I said at the committee, there was a collective shudder of horror as this was described. But some malevolent people send flashing images to folk with epilepsy because they know that it will trigger a seizure. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to hurt them. And presumably they know that they can kill them as well. It's not just hurting them. And so I mentioned that to you, and we got the head of the Epilepsy Society along to talk about it. And she made, I thought, a really excellent point, which is that if you're walking down the street, if she was walking down the street and somebody punched her, folk would instantly try and help her. Some people would chase the assailant. The police would instantly become involved and everybody would be terribly upset about it. But because it happens online, somehow there's a sense that it's not really as important. And as she pointed out, if you're, standing on a subway platform, on a tube platform, and you glance at your phone and somebody sent you these flashing images, you could have a seizure, you could fall under the tube. It's deeply, deeply serious and wickedly cruel.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt of the intent on this. It's not saying I've posted something I didn't think people would take offense, but they have. This is absolutely clear that it's being done with intent. And this is not really a freedom of expression issue. It's flashing image being sent to cause this medical
it's assault.
Condition. Assault. It is an assault, exactly.
It is assault. And when they contacted me, when the society contacted me, they wanted me to talk about a wee boy called Zach, who is a child living with epilepsy. And he's been relentlessly bullied and targeted with this. And he's a plucky wee boy, and he's determined to stand up against the bullies. And they've used him as the poster boy for their campaign. And they asked me to publish an article about it, which I did in the Daily Express of all papers. But the Express has actually run a good campaign on this. And what they want is for us to pass something called Zach's Law. Now, I'm hoping that we can incorporate the provisions of Zach's Law into our legislation and for it to become a criminal offence to do this. But I don't know about you, Damien. I mean, what do you think would motivate somebody to want to do this? Because I wasn't quite clear at the end of our session talking to the woman from the Epilepsy Society who these wicked people are.
I think that's a really interesting question. What would your motivation be? Because as you say, it's virtually a form of assault. You're targeting people deliberately with the intention of hurting them. I mean, why would someone do that? I mean, we talk about racism and misogyny, you know, which are terrible blights in our society and things I think sadly that are getting worse, and social media is driving them. But there are people who seek to divide society in that way and to target people aggressively to try and close people down out of public debate by bombarding them with hate. But then you see this other thing with epilepsy, which is not just a sort of vile abuse and political abuse, but just something which is based around assault and harm of an individual person. But I wanted, I mean, I think as well, I mean, we heard, you know, I think very movingly from Ian Russell during the session, the father of Molly Russell. And, you know, I think he spoke for everyone who's got a, in some ways, I think, you know, as a father of a 14-year-old daughter.
Yeah, you made that point. Yeah. Your daughter's the same age as his daughter was.
Yeah, that we all feel very acutely that in that online world, no matter what protection and guidance you try and create for your children, you can't follow them into that black box of their smart device and the social media accounts that they're on. And with personalization of social media, you can't never quite replicate the experience they go through. And again, there, why would someone seek to glamorize self-harm to vulnerable teenage girls?
I wonder if some of the people who do it don't think that the recipients are real people. I wonder if they think that they're in a, you know, they're in some kind of video game where they're not actually attacking real people, but characters. And I wonder if that is the problem. I keep asking the question at the committee, and I think I've asked it, you know, three or four times, of people who describe horrible things that have happened to them. Who are the people? Have you any sense of who the people are who are attacking you? Asked it of Rio Ferdinand as well. Because I think it's very important to remember all the time when you're in social media that you should never do or say anything that you wouldn't do or say to somebody in real life. Mm. I mean, I know myself, I like all of us as politicians, we get bombarded with offensive stuff. And I remember early on, because I just joined Twitter when I got involved in politics in 2015. And, you know, somebody, it was a friend of a friend, was sending me really rude stuff. And I wrote back to her. I don't do this anymore, but I was a newbie in social media. And I wrote back saying, you know, we've mutual friends. I can imagine meeting you at a party or a dinner party or something. I can't imagine you saying any of this stuff to me in real life. What makes it okay to say it on Twitter? To which she didn't really have any answer.
No, that's right. And I think we've seen as well, I think we saw it in this most recent evidence session from Nina Jankovic's evidence, similar to what Rio Ferdinand said as well, is that while some people say, well, if you don't like what's on social media, just delete the apps. But as Nina said, well, I can't. For my job means I've got to be on social media. I've got to be engaging with people on social media because of the job I do. but I can't escape it. And it's not abuse that might take place in a location that you can leave. It's happening in the palm of your hand in your own home.
And the thing about children that parents like you always say is that in the old days, you know, when we were at school, you could get bullied at school and then you would leave. And maybe the journey home, you know, there might be bullying issues, but once you were back in your house with your mom and your dad or your, whoever you lived with, you had a place of safety.
Yeah.
And now the bullies can follow you into your house and they can persecute you in your bedroom. And it's 24-hour bullying. And we've really got to be able to do something about this to help kids like Zach, to the epileptic kids, and to help all these children who are being encouraged to self-harm.
Absolutely, you're right. And I think you're right to say there is in the social media world, there is no safe space, because that space, you know, that abuse can follow you wherever you go. And I mean, this takes us once again back to the central role that the platforms play themselves, because they are the guardians of this space. They're the ones that can see into the corners of this world that no one else can see. And, you know, I felt throughout this process and indeed over the last few years that, you know, this, we can't start to tackle these problems unless we've got the effective cooperation of the companies themselves.
They don't care.
They don't care.
They clearly don't care. We had somebody from TikTok appearing before the Culture and Media Select Committee, and their proud boast is that whenever harmful content is put up, they take it down really quickly. And it took my team about 5 minutes to find this woman in the States, young, very beautiful, young, glamorous woman. She could have been a pop star. And she was telling folk not to take the COVID vaccinations. I don't think she'd be 23 or 24. She had squillions of followers. And I imagine a lot of young men were following her, given her profile. She wasn't really hard to find at all, because it was hashtag anti-vax. We managed to find her in a few moments. TikTok had made no effort whatsoever to take down all her videos. And in the course of my cross-examination of her before the select committee, TikTok managed to take down the videos.
Yeah.
But they only did so because we were pointing a direct light at them. And I don't know about you, but I think we've got to get much tougher on the social media companies. And almost certainly, I think we've got to hit them financially, or threaten to hit them financially, unless they up their game.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, your point said they don't care. They don't care enough to do something about it, because these are not new problems. We've been talking about this for years now. If self-regulation worked, if they wanted to solve the problem, they would have done it by now. But they're dragging their feet. And, you know, we've seen over the last week or so as well, the investigation by the Wall Street Journal, which is exposing the vast amounts of research that companies have commissioned themselves into these problems, Facebook in particular, and yet they're not acting on those results.
And I can't quite understand the extent to which they don't care, because the reputational damage that these companies now suffer is really quite noticeable. And I don't think anybody talks affectionately about Facebook anymore. And I remember when I first went on Facebook, and it was great because you found old friends from school and people that you'd lost touch with, and family members that you'd lost touch with. And sometimes you had to hide from people that you'd lost touch with very deliberately. But it was a fun thing, wasn't it? And you'd post your holiday pictures. And it's now become a poisonous cesspit, and Twitter infinitely worse. And so much of it is because the bullying and the targeting and the harassment and the racism and the homophobia. And I just don't know why, when they know now that they are going to get eventually hit by legislation, why they're not trying to get ahead of the curve.
I thought in the Wall Street Journal investigation, I thought one of the things that was most chilling was the advice the researchers gave to Facebook about Instagram, saying that we know that teenage girls believe that it causes anxiety and depression, but they feel they can't not visit the app. The fear of missing out is so great that they keep coming back. But it almost feels like it's a form of a form of self-punishing form of behavior. And on TikTok, and again, my 14-year-old daughter has talked to me about this, is TikTok for you, which is when you want to search for things, it's the recommendations it makes to you before you even search. And there you'll see, you know, images glamorizing self-harm or diet programs that could lead people to, you know, extreme and unhealthy weight loss. And this stuff is being, not just the stuff that people are searching for, but it's being pushed at them aggressively by the platform itself.
Extraordinary. My best friend at school used to self-harm, and I'd never known about it before. he used to cut his arm, and he was going through a terrible family situation with his parents. And I just remember spending so much time with him at the time, trying to get him to talk about it and trying to ask him why he was doing it. And he was deeply ashamed and embarrassed that he was doing it. But of course, the thing was, he wasn't meeting anybody else who was doing it. It was a solitary activity. But now, because of social media, folk who do it can meet other people who do it and can get folk who are encouraging them to do it. And that takes it to a whole new level.
Well, and that's right. And that's, I think, the thing I think we've got to be particularly concerned about is, you know, if you're self-harming and yet you go on Instagram and you see what they call barcoding, where people are showing marks on their inner arms that they've made like a pattern of a barcode, then it's almost legitimizing it. So when other people are doing it clearly, and you're more likely to find yourself in a community of other people that regard self-harm as a part of their lives. And it does this, you know, does this content legitimize it in the way that, you know, hate speech directed towards women, racism online, as we've heard, I think quite consistently in this inquiry, that people fear it normalizes that violent behavior, and it will lead to not just people being hurt online, but it'll change people's real world behaviors as well.
I think what's great about what we're doing in the inquiry, and I always say this to people who assume that parliamentary work is all the Prime Minister's questions and the yabu sucks and the shouting and the pantomime. And as you know, pantomime's gone downhill a lot recently as well. But a lot of people think of it as...
Dumbed down, I think it was.
Dumbed down, yes. Pantomime's dumbed down, as the new Secretary of State has told us, because it used to be so highbrow. But a lot of people think, don't they, that is what the House of Commons is about. But actually, I think these select committees and the bill committees can do really good work. And I think the most important thing that we're doing at the moment is giving voice to people who feel that they've got no voice. The social media platforms aren't listening to them, but they can turn up before our committee. They're not going to be rushed. They're going to get the chance to talk about what's happening in their lives. And they're going to kick the ball into our court, aren't they? And they're going to say to us, what can you do to help? Because we're telling you what the problem is, we're telling you what our experience is, and now it's over to you as politicians to come up with a solution. And that's empowering for them, and it feels like we've got the potential to do something really worthwhile.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for joining me on the Joint Committee podcast.
Pleasure.
Thanks. You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, focused on the Joint Select Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. I'm Damien Collins. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and please join us next time.